Garner Ted Armstrong.
Well, I'm especially interested in anything you have regarding evolution. Surely this must be the biggest fraud in modern education. It represents the basic foundation upon which all modern philosophy rests, and its universal acceptance marked a turning point away from God. And then she said to speak out against evolution in education today is to be branded a professional incompetent. I've noticed recently some of the leading theological figures on the face of the earth have been confronted by atheists and evolutionists who have been asking them embarrassing questions. And they've had a tough time explaining about their belief in God. And so I've been having a little bit of fun on the World Tomorrow program lately by asking evolutionists some embarrassing questions and asking them to explain their faith. And we've been talking about all the various creatures in the world because there should be some rules by which you play the game. You should be able to take any given situation, any sociological pattern of man, man's very nature, man's wars and his problems today, you should be able to take the creatures in our environment, the very laws that regulate our universe and solar system and all of the life forms on this earth, and then, as it were, walk back through history and to see how logically, based upon present resident forces and present causes that you see all about you, that evolution could have occurred in each specific and individual case. And I've been talking about the woodpeckers and about animals and some of the crazy upside-down things they seem to do and why it is they're perfectly equipped to do this and asking questions of evolutionists. Now, I talked about birds for a while, and we talked about all of the fantastic adaptation it would require for a lizard or a reptile to turn into a bird. Now, I've been thinking more about that lately, and it seems to me like they really missed the boat there, like they should have said that maybe birds came from mice. Because the more I think of ancient reptiles leaping for millions of years and never getting off the ground, and then finally somehow becoming birds, the more amazing it becomes. Now, have you ever studied ornithology a little bit yourself? Have you been like the average person? You leave all the questions about theology or evolution to the experts. You're pretty well convinced because of the articles you see in various scientific journals and publications, or a little article from time to time by the science editor of a newspaper, that evolution must be true. Many, many theologians themselves believe evolution is probably true and try somehow to straddle a fence between the two. Many, many theologians believe that much of the Bible is a myth. Now, I happen to believe and have proved that the Bible is absolutely true. Oh, yes, I mean, I'll go way out on a limb and tell you right now that I absolutely believe in special creation, that Adam and Eve literally did exist in a literal garden. I believe in the flood and can prove it. In the time of Noah, Jonah, Daniel, Elijah, Christ, you name them, I believe in every last one of the Bible characters. And furthermore, I've proved it to myself. Now that you've had your chuckle, let's go back and find out whether or not any such belief as that would be rational, because most theologians would tell you, well, now, I mean, I accept part of what Christ taught, but I don't accept all the Bible literally. I take it with a grain of salt, or like as not two or three. And so they claim that perhaps Adam and Eve were nothing but a myth, and it was a sort of a myth which is supposed to explode or explain some divine truth. Now, whatever that means, I'm not sure, and I don't think they are either. But let's go back and investigate this idea about birds and reptiles and some of these fantastic creatures that we see all about us. Have you ever wondered about the difference between reptiles and birds? Now, I'm talking about modern, up-to-the-moment things. This is as modern as the space age in which you live. It's as modern as America's soft landing on the moon and the pictures from Mars. They claim birds, all of them that you see about you, from a cassowary to a canary, came from lizards. Came from reptiles. Now, you know, I didn't even read this anywhere in a book, but when I look at a reptile and realize in past studies that reptiles have the slowest metabolism of all creatures and are given to live the longest lives, when a lot of them are so cold in body temperature that they practically feel dead and clammy to the touch, when I realize that reptiles just ooze all kinds of secretions out of their scales or skin, and that they have oily secretions to help them slip through the water and so on, when I realize the method of their breathing, when I realized the armor plates on some, the fins or scales on others, the tremendous claws and the tails and so on. And then I begin to try to imagine the very first time, because now let's all slow down and admit one thing. There had to be a first. There just did. There had to be one reptile in one place at one time who first began to fly. And if he only flew a few feet and broke his neck, then he didn't survive. And the others, if they tried it and flew a few feet and broke their neck, they didn't survive either, and so there weren't any reptiles left. Now, let's admit a few things. You don't see any half-developed birds today. You ever look at a bird skeleton? Little eggshell thin skull, little tiny brain, great huge eyes, tremendous lungs. His breast is shaped like a keel. He's got tremendous muscle in his breast. And his legs are fixed up so that they even lock in a clutching sort of a position at night so that a bird can perch on a little tiny twig and lock his legs on it and go to sleep, and you can't possibly get him loose unless you wake him up. It's just impossible. Now, not only that, but even his bones are porous. He has an air frame. And there's something, and if I had the World Book Encyclopedia, I could read that to you here, that science looks at these things about birds, and then it begins to tell you how it can understand about birds. Now, you probably thought that science certainly must understand just about all there is to know about birds. Well, they don't, you see. There are air sacs all through a bird's body, and those air sacs are filled with air from the bird's lungs. Scientists, instead of seeing the obvious, that this has to do with buoyancy and also has to do with cooling of the air frame while it's flying, and the bird has a fantastically rapid metabolism, just about the most rapid of all, instead of seeing the obvious, they say, well, now we think that in some way this helps to aid birds in their breathing, but we're not quite sure how. Now, that's very interesting. But go back to the time when the very first reptile took to the air. If he took to the air, he had to have a much more rapid metabolism. He had to have perfectly developed breastbone and breast muscles. He had to have wings, not fins or scales. He had to have perfectly developed feathers, and you've never seen a halfway developed one. They're always perfect. There isn't any such thing as a crude feather on the face of the earth, unless it was in your hat and you've sat on it a few times. There isn't any such thing as a crude feather. You don't see half feathers, part scales, part lizards, or part birds. You see them develop perfectly all the way. Now, you know, frogs can take in water through their skin and give out various secretions, and fish give out oils from between their scales. But birds don't sweat. Now, if anybody ever needed a sweat, a bird does. You know, people say, well, this poor deer is going to starve to death. She eats like a canary. Well, look, if she eats like a canary, she should take up the fat lady's position in the circus, because a canary will eat its weight every day if it's really energetic. The smaller the bird, the more it eats proportionate to its size and weight, so that the little bee hummingbird will literally eat its weight and more every single day. Larger birds don't have to eat quite that much. Isn't it amazing that a creature, given all these millions of years of time, could have gradually changed? Sort of defies description, doesn't it? Now, you might ask an evolutionist about this, or as they say in Britain, an evolutionist, and he will say, well, I have faith that it happened. Or will he say that? I don't really know what they will say about that particular part of it. I've seen they have in their textbooks that we guess this and we think that and we hypothesize the other thing and we think that maybe, and given enough time, this could have, and we are coming to believe that, and it is commonly assumed that, and it's popularly accepted that, but you don't find very much proof. Now, let's go back to these birds, if they became birds, which I think you can prove they didn't. If they became birds, let's just pick individual birds and see how they survive. You ever see a water ouzel? Now, not only did this creature, maybe he's going the other direction. You'd have to figure that maybe evolution doesn't work all in one direction, from simple to complex, and comes along in an orderly fashion at all, but it could be quite chaotic and go in the opposite direction. At least that's the only explanation I know of for a water ouzel. Because a water ouzel, also called a dipper, which I have seen fishing along streams in Oregon time and time again, is the kind of a bird that gets his food off the bottom of swiftly rushing streams. Yet he flies. He's a very good flying bird, a kind of a thrush type of bird, because you'll see him around the banks of streams and on rocks and under shrubs and brush. And he'll stand on a rock, and his little posterior keeps dipping up and down, so they call him a dipper. All of a sudden, he disappears, and he's walked into that swiftly rushing river. And maybe 40 yards upstream, there he pops up on another rock. and he's been walking along with his wings partially outspread as diving planes, forcing himself to stay on the bottom when he weighs nowhere near as much, you know, and here he is walking along picking up larvae of mayflies, stoneflies, various nymphs and so on off the bottom of a stream. Now, how did this crazy bird, let's go back and analyze this, if he evolved this proclivity that he has. Here he was on the bank of the stream. He's eating. What is he eating? Well, whatever you find on the bank of the stream, grubs, bugs, worms, gnats, mosquitoes, and flies, and all kinds of. If he'd waited a while, stoneflies, mayflies, all the nymphs would have come out of the stream and been available to him in the air, on the branches, or floating downstream on the top. Now, how did the water ouzel, millions of years ago, first find out there were any bugs in the bottom of the creek in the first place? You see, the first water ouzel was not equipped with wings that were oiled and like a duck, a sort of a cross between a water bird, but he's not. He's got perching legs and he's got flying wings and he's not built like a duck, but he wasn't equipped with the oil, so he had to, in some way, how did he do it? Evolve it. But he didn't evolve it until he needed to evolve it. And he didn't need to evolve it until he had to get on the bottom of the stream to survive. This is the law of evolution. But the point is, he had to be surviving on the bank of the stream or else he died. And if he died, there weren't any more water ouzels. And if he didn't die, then he was surviving where he was, on the side of the stream, right? Or is this crazy reasoning? It makes sense to me. And to most people I've talked to, I've run across a few that are out of touch with reality. But if he was on the side of the stream and he was surviving in that habitat, he didn't need to go into the bottom of the stream. And unless he needed to, he couldn't have evolved the equipment with which to do it. How did he get oil on his feathers and diving planes instead of wings, or at least wings that double for diving planes? Well, I think it's fair to ask evolution these questions. I think it's fair to try to put your mind to any given creature you know and to ask yourself, what about that time, that inevitable moment when the very first bird flew? And then just use logic. Now, I've seen theologians, one very leading theological organization publishes a booklet that says, men reasoned, and men reasoned well. Now that's almost as funny as some of the new sick jokes. Men do not reason well. If they did, mankind wouldn't be in the problems he has today. Men do not generally reason well. But this particular organization places great weight upon man's reasoning. So for the sake of maybe finding a common ground, let's go along with them temporarily. Isn't it possible to ask a few simple questions about evolution, whether you've gone to school, whether you've become a specialist, whether you've studied it much yourself, and to get some concrete answers? Isn't it fair to ask evolution to explain how some of these firsts occurred and to make it logical, to make it rational? Or do you have to dispense with the entire thing in a few paragraphs of time and come up with a fantastically interdependent and complex life forms, all of the environment of man that we see about us today? Each animal occupying a highly specialized interdependent position. Take the cycles in the sea. You've got the little microorganisms of plankton, all of them different, millions and millions of creatures, and they exist in the warmer water way up near the top, and little tiny fish feed upon them, or like as not even huge whales. Which came first, the plankton or the whales? Now, did the plankton evolve into other fish? Well, yet, you know, they have to exist there or else the other fish could not breathe. They perform a fantastic function at sea. They keep the water aerated. They keep the water filled with oxygen so the other fish can breathe. And the plankton not only provide fantastic food at sea, and there wouldn't be any other kind of food for the billions of fish in the sea if it weren't for plankton. And the fish have to eat it. Now, which came first? Did the plankton exist first? Or did the fish exist first? What about the little microbes inside the fish? And what about some fish that only exist by feeding off other fish, like the ones that clean shark's teeth? What about some of the fish that swim in and out of other fish's mouths and pick their teeth for a living? You can take the African tick birds and the like that get along pretty well with giraffes and rhinoceros. You know, you want to go back and ask yourself about the woodpecker. He's a little different. He doesn't even have bones joined together in his neck. If he did, he'd have the most wrenching headache in the world. Now, let's go back to the very first woodpeckers in all of history. Here they were. They couldn't have known, because they don't have superhuman or X-ray vision, they could not have known that there were grubs inside of a tree. No dumb, unsuspecting woodpecker would have figured that one out. Here's a tree, solid bark, not one hole in it. Nobody has ever been a woodpecker yet. Now, here's a bird, and he's got a beak like any other bird. Now, there are cross beaks, there are grasping beaks, there are beaks that are used for storage. There are curved beaks for sucking the nectar out of various flowers. There are pecking beaks. There are all kinds of cracking beaks, such as the big hornbills and parrots and so on. All of them specially adapted for a specific place at a specific environment in a specific part of the world, you know. Now, here's the woodpecker. Can you imagine? The first naive, unsuspecting woodpecker gets it in his head that he will try to get a grub out of a tree. And so he dies of a broken neck. At least he suffers a wrenching headache. And he goes home and he decides, man, what an experiment. I lose half my beak. I don't get a thing. This oak tree is pretty tough. I think I'll just keep living where I was. Now, let's go back to the primary sensible premise in the beginning again. If the woodpecker was not a woodpecker and he had to become a woodpecker to survive, then he already did exist in some other form. Is that correct? Maybe he even already had a red head. But he was existing in some other form. He did not need to peck wood to get food, right? Because he had to exist before he pecked into trees to get food. Now, if he was, he was existing fine, and I can prove to you in any forest that I know of that there's an awful lot more food outside of the trunk of a tree than there is inside of it. Can you see the first primeval forest, thousands of woodpeckers lying around dead, broken necks, or lying around dizzy and cross-eyed with blinding, dizzying headaches? It doesn't make sense. Now, woodpeckers don't even have the bones joined in the neck. They have instead a rubbery kind of tissue that makes up for some of the bones that are not there. They have a specially designed head so they can keep level-headed as they attack these trees. A woodpecker has a straight beak, very hard, very pointed, powerful neck muscles, and a very heavy, thick skull for a bird. Now, he doesn't even have x-ray vision. He just pounds away until he finally fights his way beneath the bark. Then you know what he does? He's got a tongue. If you've seen this strip that a lot of comics are carrying now called BC, or is it the other one? Yeah, it's BC, I believe, where once in a while the anteater pulls a trick on these poor unsuspecting ants. Which came first, the anteater or the ants? There are only two species of anteaters on the face of the earth, and that's the only thing they can live on is ants, and they can't live on anything else. And it's a good thing the ants evolved first. But if there weren't any anteaters, you'd sure have an awful lot of ants in the world. I'll tell you that for sure. Well, anyhow, this anteater, once in a while, will play a trick on these unsuspecting ants. And I saw this one frame where he lay down behind this knoll and he snaked his tongue out and crossed the top of this little stream. These two ants came along, one said to the other, oh, a bridge. You know, they got halfway across and this thing began to move toward the anteater's mouth and they said, oh, no. And here they went. Well, it is a fact that a woodpecker does exactly that. He pecks a hole in a tree, he snakes his tongue in there, it looks like a little thin worm, a whole bunch of ants attack it, he whips the ants into his mouth, and then does it all over again. They keep running up and attacking what they think is this little skinny worm lying inside this groove of a tree. And that's a fact. That's literally the way a woodpecker gets his lunch. Now, how did this bird evolve all of that? He had to be successful the first trip around, or else he wasn't going to survive. And if he didn't survive, there aren't any woodpeckers. And if there aren't any woodpeckers, we're both insane. But there are woodpeckers, and they are absolutely equipped perfectly to do just what they do. And the first one had to be perfectly successful. Not even to mention the fact that he's got specially equipped claws so that he can go up or down. I've seen woodpeckers run down a tree with their head down and their tail up. And maybe you have too if you've watched them very much. Now, all animals are specialized, not just a few that I'm mentioning. You take a basilisk, that's a water runner. It's a small lizard that can run on the surface of the water. He uses his tail as a balancing organ. He sticks it up in the air, and his feet serve to distribute his weight evenly. And he's got to go to a certain speed, because if he slows down, he starts to sink. Now, can you imagine the first millions of generations of basilisks? They're running around, glub, glub, you know, sinking slowly in the water with their tail just disappearing. And how would they ever know that the minute they slow down, they start to sink and it's too late to speed up again because they're already underneath. So they had to do it perfectly. The first trip had to be absolutely successful. And why would you think he has to seek his livelihood on the surface of the water? Well, no other lizard can compete with him out there, that's for sure, because the rest of them would drown. But if evolution is true, then the basilisk had to experiment for thousands of years, each time drowning. But if he drowned each time, he wasn't there for the next time, and that doesn't make sense. So you can ask a question about any type of creature there is on the face of the earth, and you can still come up with some very embarrassing questions for evolutionists. You really can. It's just that they don't come to grips with this type of thing because they feel they don't have to. As a matter of fact, they themselves will admit in some of the writings on evolution that there is much they don't know about these creatures. They don't know how geese migrate. They don't know about the Arctic tern, which I've mentioned several times on the program now. They don't know about animal surgery, how it is that certain lizards and snakes can run off and leave half of themselves and grow a new part, and how it is that some of them have a tail with an eye on the end of it, and he's sitting on a fence, and a hawk comes along, and he runs off and leaves the tail, the hawk attacks the wrong end, and he grows himself a new one real happily, and the first few million years he tried this, you know, he hadn't grown the eye yet and couldn't leave the tail, so the hawks kept killing him off. It doesn't make sense. Every creature you look at is so highly specialized, it's an amazing study all by itself. You ought to pick up an encyclopedia sometime. You don't need to be all that educated. You don't need to be a college professor or have a doctor's degree to understand a little bit about ichthyology, ornithology, biology, microbiology. And those aren't frightening words. All you've got to do is look up the term water ouzel. Look up the term monarch butterfly. That would be a terrific study for you sometime about their patterns of migration. Study the Arctic tern that I've mentioned. Here is a crazy bird up in the Arctic that at the precise moment in the Arctic when there is more food available than at any other season takes off, even the young ones who have been born that season and have never left before, and flies all the way to the South Pole, arriving just on time. The longest migratory path of any bird on the face of the earth. Now, the first Arctic terns, of course, kept doing this, but they kept turning back. First of all, they would leave too late, wouldn't they? Because why leave while there's plenty of food supply? But if they left too late, then what they did, they were trying to go to the South Pole. Why? Nobody knows. Science doesn't know either, except that they do it. They do it today. They do it every year. But, you know, the warmer it got, because they were flying toward the equator, the more they became confused and probably convinced that this is not the way to colder climates and turned around and went back. So actually, the Arctic tern never migrated. But that doesn't make sense because they migrate every year. But they've got to fly at the very precise moment when there is more food supply in the Arctic than any other time of the year, fly clear across the equator, down across South America, clear down to Antarctica, and you explain that. Science can't. Matter of fact, if you want to check up on that, just look. Look for yourself in any encyclopedia. They frankly tell you they don't know why the birds do it. But they do it. And they've got navigational ability that would put a Doppler system and VOR radio to shame. It really does. It's fantastic. Now, maybe you can explain all these things by saying, well, I believe in evolution nevertheless. But that would be a little silly. It's about time you began to ask yourself, what about the Bible? Does it make sense? Is it logical that there was such a thing as a flood back during the time of Noah? And could that be proved? Does it make a bit of sense that some of these bones they have found have been sort of tampered with, and it may be some explanations have been drawn up about fossil men that are not quite true? Is it just possible, or is it insane, to postulate that man might indeed be about 6,000 years old instead of hundreds of thousands or millions of years? Now, maybe you think evolutionists have it all wrapped up in a neat, tight package. You're going to be shocked to find there is no such thing on the face of the earth as a geologic succession of strata. There's no place on the face of the earth where it exists. You'll find it's a great stratigraphical law that any so-called older stratum may be found resting conformably on top of any so-called younger stratum, any place, at any time. And you'll be shocked to find that occurs in broad areas of the earth. How do you explain sharks pressed flat? They were trapped under tons of material suddenly. How do you explain ripple marks? They had to be preserved suddenly. How do you explain tiny little footprints in sand that are now preserved in solid sandstone shales and rock? They had to be preserved suddenly. How do you explain that the predominant rock on the face of the earth is sedimentary, water deposited? How do you explain the fact that there are billions of cubic yards of material and proof about the Noachian deluge, that it was worldwide, and that the geologic succession of strata is an absolute incredible error? There is nothing to substantiate it on the face of this earth. Oh, doesn't that sound pretentious? You bet it does, but it's true. And you can prove it if you want to look it up for yourself. You take a look at some of the bones that people have selected to portray the Neanderthal man. And then you find in the Bible discussions about giants. Now, is this just coincidence? The Bible talks about giant races of people. Goliath, you know, was perhaps 12 feet. People think 10. Oh, no. Saul was perhaps close to 10. He was head and shoulders above all the other peoples in the nation of Israel back during the time when men were really men and women, glad of it, as they like to say. You need to check for yourself and find out about these giants on the earth during that day. Find out about the origin of life. Find out about the Neanderthal man, the Cro-Magnon man, the new find of so-called Zinji or Zingiantropus africanus, and find out just how many bones they found. Remember the little old woman who was supposed to be millions of years of age that they found near Alexandria in Egypt until they finally discovered it was the kneecap of an elephant? Remember the filth-down man that was a deliberate hoax on the part of some university students to hoax their professor that was in your history books, or I should say your evolution and biology books and mine for years and years and years? They even had the lips, the face, the hair, and all the rest of it. You will see pictures of these men and read more about it, which will be a key for any further study you want to do if you write for our article on giants. It has to do with giants on the earth in those days of which the Bible speaks back in the book of Genesis. Just write for the article on giants, and you'll find something about the Neanderthal man, the Piltdown man, the Java man, the Peking man, and Africanus, and so on. And also write for this article entitled The Origin of Life. Is it really true that simple became complex? That life came from death or from not living, from nothing? A very good friend of mine who wrote that article and is a professor at Ambassador College went to another course at, I think, USC or UCLA, I forget which one, and it was entitled The Origin of Life. On his orientation day, on the day, the very first course, the professor said, "You know, I'm sorry that this course is entitled The Origin of Life. I wish it weren't, for we know almost nothing about the origin of life." That was to ensure that the students would realize that the course was not actually going to tell them about the origin of life, but they were going to make a few guesses around the fringes. You need to write for this article on the origin of life and the one on giants. Did they exist? And is there a logical, biblical explanation for what you see in the rocks? And also write for the booklets, Does God Exist? And the proof of the Bible. They are absolutely free of charge. There is no price. Now, you can make a few comparisons and ask a few questions and come to understand about evolution for yourself. You don't need to leave your opinions to the paid experts. Write for these articles. You'll be happy you did. As a matter of fact, I received a letter from a student in Louisiana that said he had written a paper on evolution from the standpoint of biology and the Bible, and his teachers were so impressed that he had been asked to give the paper in detail to his classes, and several teachers wanted a copy of it, and he had read some of our booklets and articles. So you write for it. It's free of charge, no price, and also the Plain Truth magazine if you send your letter to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. That's Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California.
You have heard The World Tomorrow. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.